Chapter 43, Mooreya, November 1872. A boy from the village was waiting on the shore when Thomas pulled the canoe up onto the sand in a warm rain and unloaded the fish he had speared. Keaani stepped out of the cabin with a piece of peppermint candy for the messenger, who popped it into his mouth and skipped happily along the surf line back towards Ha'apiti. Thomas settled into a wicker chair on the porch and opened the sealed oilskin pouch the boy had delivered. Inside were several letters. The first he had received in months. They were addressed to Akoni at the Lolani Palace in Honolulu and took 3 weeks to arrive by schooner in Papeete, where they were delivered to Aubert before being handed off to a trusted friend to deliver to Thomas on Mooreya. He opened the first letter, which his editor Andrew Witten at the San Francisco Chronicle had penned in early October. "I'm well," Witten wrote, "but you won't be surprised to know that Colin Stafford has the long knives out for the paper. He has threatened, bribed, and cajoled most of the hotels, shops, and restaurants in town to stop advertising with us, and our delivery wagons have been vandalized a dozen or more times. But we're not giving up. Enough good people continue to buy the daily paper to keep us in ink and newsprint. Be well, lad, and come back to us as soon as you are able." The next letter was from Cam Sung Kwan, the owner of the Rue de Paris restaurant, whose niece had overheard Stafford's instructions to Fitch Donegan to go to Hawaii and kill Thomas. "Business was booming," said his diminutive friend, "and we all look forward to your return to our tables, especially Mrs. Kwan." The last and most important letter in the watertight pouch was dated 3 weeks earlier. It came from the missionary leader Edward Grimthorpe, in whose care Thomas had left Tiana after he spirited her away from the leper colony on Molokai. "The child is well and often visits Princess Noelani at the palace," Grimthorpe wrote. "She is being tutored in several subjects and shows a real head for learning." Thomas smiled and hoped that the news had made it to Tiana's parents at Kalawao. Leprosy would inevitably claim their lives, but knowing their daughter was safe and doing well might ease their suffering. "The other information I must share will be, I am afraid, quite distressing for you, Thomas," continued the missionary. "I have it on good authority from the prefect of police here in Honolulu that your plantation on Lanai is to be seized by order of court and its assets handed over to Wallace Stafford's bank." Thomas was so visibly startled that Keaani sensed something awful had happened. She came over and sat on the arm of his chair and put her hand on his shoulders. In reply, he simply handed her the first page of Grimthorpe's letter before turning to the next page. "According to my police friend," the letter went on, "your partner, William Fortnight, came to Honolulu just weeks after you left the islands and withdrew the entire $50,000 line of credit you secured for plantation operations. He also emptied the business accounts and then just vanished. Stafford sent people to Lanai when Fortnight missed the first payment that was due. They found that operations had come to a halt and that only your foreman Kukane and a handful of workers remained on the land. Hawaiian law allows the bank to begin foreclosure proceedings the day the second payment is late, which means that by the time you receive this letter, your plantation will be in the hands of the courts. I am so very sorry to have to tell you this." Thomas took a drink of water and handed the second page of Grimthorpe's letter to Keaani. Theft, foreclosure, ruin, he thought. If only he had known of this earlier, it would have been worth risking discovery by Donegan to return and fight for his plantation and to deal with Fortnight. Keaani shared a worried glance with him, and it took all his inner strength to muster a half-reassuring smile before he returned to the final page of the letter. "Sadly, there is more to report. Hawaiian courts are notoriously slow, and Akoni tells me that he is using all his personal influence to slow their hearings on your plantation even more. He believes that it will take at least 5 to 6 months for the foreclosure to wind its way to conclusion. If you can reconcile the account before then by paying the bank, ownership of the plantation will revert to you, though, unfortunately, to Fortnite as well. That was a serious load of trouble, Thomas thought, but perhaps not as grim as the missionary was suggesting. When he read on, he realized how wrong that optimistic assessment was. Stafford is not waiting for the courts, however, Grimthorpe wrote. My police friend tells me that he has assembled a group of toughs to come after you and collect the $50,000 by whatever means necessary. The next line sent a chill up Thomas's back. They know you fled to Tahiti, Thomas. Apparently the leader of the men coming after you is some kind of Tahitian warrior with a personal vendetta against you. Do you know of such a person, and would he know how to find you? Thomas cursed under his breath. Aata, he thought. It could be no one else. He looked across at Keaani, who had just finished the second page of the missionary's letter and was waiting for the final page with worry etched across her face. Why did I share this with her before reading it myself? He thought. But having allowed her to read the first two pages, there was no way he could hold back the last one. I love you, he signed to her as he handed the page over, and I promise everything is going to be all right. Tears formed in her eyes as she read the last of Grimthorpe's letter. She dropped it to the ground and looked into Thomas's eyes with an expression of sadness and fear. He stared down at the paper. I don't know how, he thought to himself, I just don't know. Then he raised his head and placed his hands gently on either side of his wife's face. I promise, he said. He went into the cabin and sat at the small desk beneath the painting Aubert had given them. He took out a piece of paper, an inkwell and pen, and quickly scribbled a note to the artist. Then he walked along the beach to the village and sought out two of the young men who had helped build his house and offered them the equivalent of 2 days' good wages in Papeete to leave immediately for Papara, a 3-hour sail across the channel. Wait for him and bring him back with you, Thomas told the men as they climbed into the outrigger and pulled up the sail. And what if he can't come with us? One of the men asked. He will come, Thomas replied in a quiet voice. An hour after sunset, the outrigger dropped sail and slid up to the beach in front of Thomas and Keaani's cabin. It was starting to rain as Aubert climbed the steps and joined Thomas, Keaani, and Timothy Boswell on the covered porch. The artist grinned when he saw Keaani was holding a bottle of wine and a glass for him. Thanks for coming, Emile, Thomas said. I am sorry to break into your day like this. The Frenchman downed the glass of wine in a single gulp before taking a chair alongside his friends. Keaani refilled his glass and hugged him before sitting down. The note simply said you were in trouble, said Aubert. What can I do? Thomas was pleased that his friend asked how he could help before he asked what kind of trouble he was in. He filled his own glass and told Aubert about the letter from Grimthorpe. When that was done, Aubert nodded and looked across at Boswell. Thomas somehow manages to step into more piles of steaming merde than any man I know, he began. He waited for the group to laugh and added, I think we're going to have busy times ahead, my friends. Thomas and I have come up with an idea a bit wild, but we believe it could work, Boswell said. Aubert's eyes twinkled in the lamplight. Wild? But your timing is perfect. I was telling Oceana only this morning that our existence was becoming a bit mundane. Your wild plan may be just the antidote we need to escape our increasingly monotonous daily routine. Thomas shook his head and smiled. No one who knew Aubert would describe the artist's life as dull. You may have a change of heart when you hear us out, Emile. And I'm afraid Timothy may have chosen too mild a word to describe what we have in mind. Aubert lit a cigar and looked out into the stormy night. Whatever your plans may be, mes bon amis, I assure you they cannot be so extreme as to frighten me away. Thomas looked across at Boswell, and then Keani. They both nodded for him to continue, and he pulled his chair a little closer to Aubert and began to speak. I am not the only one tonight who is in some degree of peril, Emile. The artist looked puzzled. The bank wants my money and my hide. My partner has cheated me, and somewhere out there an Irish assassin bides his time until he can get me in his gun sights again. Thomas saw Keani shiver at those words. But you also are in danger, my friend. As things are now, you risk seeing your life's work rot away in that cave without the world having the great opportunity, the great blessing of seeing your work in person. For the first time that evening, Aubert's expression took on a serious cast. Thomas was right. He was at the peak of his artistic skill. And yet every work he completed ended up rolled up in tubes and stored away. That was not the life he wished for himself and Oceana. And your proposal, your plan, will somehow remedy both of our dire situations? Aubert finally asked. 'Twould be merveille beyond my poor ability to describe, if such a plan could be pulled off. How long would it take you to prepare a dozen of your finest paintings for shipping? Boswell suddenly blurted out. Aubert raised his hands in a questioning gesture. My paintings are the plan? Not exactly, Thomas answered, but they are a very important part. I am all ears, said the artist. Keani filled their glasses, and Thomas laid out the plan he and Boswell had concocted only a few hours earlier. I need to pay the bank if I am to save my plantation, my reputation, and, quite possibly, my life. You need to have representation for your work, and to sell enough of them to justify your remaining here in the islands. Aubert sat in silence for a moment. And who do you propose would represent my work? He finally said. Are there knowledgeable artist professionals hereabout that I have somehow not run into in the course of day-to-day living? Keani stood up and moved behind Thomas. She placed her hands on his shoulders and smiled. You? Aubert thundered. God's wounds, my friend! But you wouldn't even know which end of a hog's hairbrush to dip into the paint! Thomas and Boswell laughed, but Keani appeared to have been stung by the artist's rebuke. Aubert took note of her discomfort. He stood and took her hand. It's all right, my child. I am simply a bit dumbfounded by the idea. Thomas set down his wine glass. You are right that I don't know the first thing about selling art, but I can learn. It will take me nearly 6 weeks to travel to New York City. And? At the mention of New York, Aubert's face lit up. New York? By the stars, my friend, New York? A gallery on every street corner, most of them hungry for new work. And better yet, the new Metropolitan Museum of Art is scheduled to open sometime late this year. It would be the perfect venue for my canvases. He leaned over and slapped Thomas on the back. The planets are aligned, good friends. I can feel it. He threw back his head and laughed. Package my canvases for travel, you say? Consider it done. There is more, Emile, Thomas said, about the money. I have a little set aside I can give you for travel, Aubert volunteered. No, I can manage those expenses myself, Thomas replied. I mean the money we make from the sales of your work. Ah, said Aubert. What is your thinking? My best hope would be to sell enough of your work to make a sizable income for you and with my fees, for me to be able to pay enough to the bank that I will not lose my property on Lanai. Aubert took a moment to think it over. He was not concerned about sharing the money with Thomas, but he wanted to make sure he was sending enough paintings to be able to help his friend out. 2 dozen, he finally said. I will need to send 2 dozen paintings with you. Will I be able to carry that many? Thomas asked. Oh, Bear chuckled. Rolled tightly and wrapped in waterproofing, we will end up with 2 rolls, each weighing less than 15 pounds. A child could carry them. Boswell stood and raised his glass. When the others joined him, he said, "A toast to my friends, to a safe and profitable excursion into the world of fine art." They tapped their glasses together under the thickening clouds that heralded the arrival of a new storm. Aubert felt exhilarated. After 4 years of complete isolation from the international art scene, he was going to have his work shopped around to the most important galleries in the Americas. He was about to burst into song when he saw that Keani's stoic facade was crumbling, and she was fighting to hold back tears. And why wouldn't she want to cry, he realized. Her idyllic existence had been shattered in a matter of a few hours by people and events she had no connection to. Her future was being scattered to the 4 winds with each passing minute. He set down his wine and soberly contemplated the dangers the young colonel would face on his 6,000-mile journey to New York, and the obstacles that would confront him as he attempted to get the ossified snobs of the art world to give his work so much as a glance. At best, a profitable excursion, he thought. At worst, a descent into the fetid art world of confidence men, scallywags, and posers. But when he caught Thomas's eye a moment later, he flashed a broad grin and lifted his glass to the sky.
Que Dieu nous aide tous, he said cheerfully.
May God help us indeed, Thomas whispered as he looked into Keani's eyes.